So it makes me really happy today to speak a little bit about metta bhavana today on Mimi's father's 88th birthday, after that incredible dana that he offered all of us. And if as a result there are nodding heads, I won't take it personally. Yeah, it was quite a gift to all of us. And he is quite a gift to all of us. So just really dedicating this offering to him on his birthday. So I spoke last time, opening the talk, I did my last talk, with the framing story from the Metta Sutta. And today, wanting to follow that a little bit, actually, by tracing historically the many ways the Buddha spoke about metta, how the Buddha taught metta, and how this practice that we're doing now here came to be, just as a way of offering a little more context. So in the early texts, in the early suttas, the Majjhima Nikaya, the Middle Land Sayings, the Samyutta Nikaya, the Connected Discourses, the Anguttara Nikaya, the Numerical Discourses, and so on, in these early texts, over and over and over again, you find these lines that we actually chant in the evenings. I abide pervading one quarter, as the Buddha's description of how he lives. Or, I will abide pervading one quarter, as an instruction. This is what you should do. You should say this to yourself, I will abide pervading one quarter. Likewise, the second, the third, the fourth, above, below, and all around, pervading the entire world with loving kindness. This occurs when you search for it. It occurs dozens of times, literally, over and over again in different contexts. The Metta Sutta itself, the one we chant, is similar versions are both in the Samyutta Nikaya, the Connected Discourses, and the Kutika Nikaya. And also in the Anguttara Nikaya, there's a sutta called the Metta Nisamsa Sutta. And this is where the Buddha lays out those 11 benefits of metta that Sayadaw spoke of at the beginning of the retreat. That's about the extent of it in the suttas in terms of instruction. And then the commentarial tradition, there is some discussion, let's say, about this. Some people say, oh, this is an early text. Other people say, no, it's not. Included in the Nikayas, the early discourses, is a book called the Patisambhida Magga, which is where that of one version of the metta chant that we chant also in the evening. This is where that comes from. This book, this text, is traditionally ascribed to Sariputta, one of the first disciples of the Buddha, one of the main chief disciples of the Buddha. When you look at the language, scholars say, well, it's 1st, 2nd century. It's quite a bit later, 2nd century Christian, in the Christian era. And so this chant that we do, sabbe sattā, sabbe panna, sabbe bhūtā, and so on, with these four aspirations comes from the Patisambhita Magga. Later, probably, than the other stuff. And one clue that it might be later is that there's a good deal more detail than those earlier texts in terms of who the metta is radiated towards, who it's developed for, and in terms of the detail of the phrases. So it's not, I will abide pervading one quarter with this boundless metta. That's it. No, it's the four aspirations. May all beings be free from mental suffering, physical suffering, etc. So both the wishes and the beings are laid out in a good deal more detail. But it's still more or less an outline. And then when we get to the truly commentarial texts, the texts that are obviously much later and that are commentaries on the original texts, this is where that framing story for the Metta Sutta that I told, this is where that comes from. That's from the Samyutta Nikaya commentary. And then the extended exposition of how to practice Metta Bhavana in the way that we are doing here comes from the Visuddhimagga, which is a good deal later. And what we do here is basically unchanged from that. And this is a text that was written by a monk named Buddhaghosa, who had come from India to Sri Lanka in about the 5th century Christian era. So quite a bit later than the Buddha, 1,000 years or so. So it's in the Visuddhimagga, there is a whole chapter about the Brahmaviharas, and the metta practice is laid out in great detail, complete with stories, similes, instructions, what metta is, what metta isn't. So in these earlier texts, in the first texts, it's all very bare bones. It's basically a Nike instruction. Just do it. You know, there's not a whole lot of detail. And I suppose if one had the Buddha in front of them as a live role model, you wouldn't need the detail. But you have us. And we have our teachers here. And we're quite a bit removed from that in time. So we have more detail, fortunately. And as I said, in the Metta Sutta itself, the detail is a little bit more than in that main, you know, I will abide text. First of all, in the Metta Sutta, what comes, although it's not so obvious when you chant it, but there is the use of a simple phrase or a simple wish for generating the metta. In the Pali, sukhino wa kemino hontu, sabbe sata bhavantu sukhitata. May all beings be safe and happy. May all beings be happy in themselves. So one abides holding in one's heart these diverse beings, whatever living beings there may be, of various sizes, whether they're known and unknown, near or far, born or to be born, unbounded toward all living creatures. And this is what, in the later Visuddhimagga instruction, gets broken down into that gradual development that we're doing now. In the Visuddhimagga, it's obviously much more of a map. There's more of a map, and more, it seems more like a recipe. Yeah. And what's easy to miss when you read that and when you're given these bare instructions of the categories and the sequence and the, you know, simply keep radiating the metta for each, is that this is a hugely flexible and non-linear practice. So one way to hold it, hold these many categories that we're using for the metta, is not as a linear sequence that we go through, but more of a mandala. Sometimes you're this side of the mandala, sometimes you're on the other, sometimes you're in the center, sometimes you're at the edge. Depending on what's skillful, appropriate, given conditions, given the practice, given conditioning, whatever. And it doesn't matter where you are on that. One place is not more advanced than any other. Well, yes, the metta for all beings is more boundless than for myself or yourself. But metta, as Ariya had quoted, one moment of metta, pure metta, is worth more than 100 years or 100 pots of rice. There are a number of similes like this in the Buddhist texts. One moment of pure metta, whether it's for just yourself or all beings, that is worth more than I can express. And obviously more than the Buddha could express, which is why that simile was there. And through both the early texts and the Visuddhimagga, really a couple of things are emphasized. You see these things and they run like a thread through all the instructions. First is the fact that when we do any form of metta bhavana, when we develop metta, we are exposing delusion in reference to beings. Delusion here in the heart. Metta that is unbounded means towards whatever living beings exist, whether we know them or not, whether we can relate to them or not, whether we can even see them or not, near or far, born or coming to birth. The purification is of the not being able to connect with unknown beings. That's the delusion that gets purified. This sense of, I don't care. And it can be quite shocking to come to see how deeply we can not care. We just don't care. Sometimes. That's what gets purified. And while this can be shocking and ew, yucky. Seeing that is really, really, really important. Because we can admit to ourselves, I really don't care about those people or those beings. Hey, you're on your own, sorry. You know? And admitting that to ourselves, honestly. This journey of purification from this kind of not caring delusion begins with that neutral category that some of you have begun to work with. And it's such an interesting place in the practice. I really love this category. Because here is where we begin to see the invisibility of other people. How the heart just doesn't open to them. It doesn't see them. This is what can be so shocking. And in our daily lives, we encounter this all the time. Especially if you live in a big city, you see millions of people and you don't know who they are. You don't care. You just want to get to work, you know. And you want a seat on the train on the way there. Or you read the newspaper. You look at the news and, it says, 100 people killed in Yemen. Well, so what? You know, the eye just slides right over that. Because to us, 150 people in a ferry disaster in the Philippines. It's just words. The heart doesn't open to those people because it just doesn't see them. So in our daily life, we encounter this all the time without being aware of it so much. But here in the practice, we really begin to see the pain of this. This inability to connect. So this neutral category is the place where this begins to emerge. And neutral, actually, is a misnomer. The more kind of wordy version that's more accurate is the neither loved nor hated category, where the heart doesn't go towards or away from this person. And as many of you have described in your interviews, it's so interesting. As soon as there is a little bit of connection, there's no longer that feeling of neutrality. And it's very, very common for people to say, am I doing it wrong? There's no neutrality there anymore. And it went away right away. Well, yeah, that's the way it works. There is a feeling of friendly connection. Even if we just know their face, we don't know their name, we don't know where they're from, we don't know anything. But there is that sense of connection. That's when that delusion of not seeing is getting purified. These 7 billion people in the world that we share the world with, most of them are in that category. How many friends do you have? How many friends do we each have? The most important person in my world is a stranger to most people, and vice versa. And I find it so interesting to notice this in places, public places, cities, or I travel a lot. So in an airport is always such an interesting place because airports are full of people, crowded places. Everybody's going somewhere. And you can sit there and watch this endless parade of total strangers to me. And it's such an amazement. You'll never see any of these people again if you're, mostly. But to reflect for a moment, each one of those people is the center of their own universe with their own set of benefactors, dear friends, neutral people. And I'm a neutral person to them. Unknown. And then you get to the gate and you're sitting there with 300 or so people and you realize, okay, I'm going to be cooped up in this little aluminium cigar tin for 11 hours with these people. And then what's so interesting to watch in the mind and heart when that happens is then, well, I don't know about you, but I start looking around and I notice, oh, she looks nice. He looks nice. I hope I'm sitting next to that person. Ooh, I hope I'm not sitting next to that person. The preferences begin. And it can be funny because everybody's doing the same thing. So they're all looking at me or, I hope I'm not sitting next to her. It goes all ways. So invisibility begins to end when we have a little more closeness. Both in the practice and in daily life. So in the practice, it's simply to keep going with this person until there is that sense of heart closeness, that sense of an empathetic bridge to this person as another being. And with this neither loved nor hated category, it's actually not too hard to do this. It's just one person. Those of you who've been here for the first half are now working with all beings, and this is takes that invisibility to another level altogether. Because not only is it more complicated, but it's amplified by way of including every single possible being in this category, imaginable or not. So as you all know by now, we build metta by way of this empathetic bridge to all as to myself. And it's one thing to have an empathetic bridge to another person. We can kind of imagine what's going on for them as a person, even if we don't know them. It's quite another thing to have some kind of empathetic bridge to an octopus or a deva. It's impossible to have any idea whatsoever what it's like to be that being. Devas, who knows what kind of life they live. Octopus are a little easier, at least they have a body. But it's not like the body we have, you know. We're vertebrates. We live on land. We walk around on two legs. We have a brain in our heads. We have two hands. An octopus has no skeleton, lives in the water, has eight legs, has a brain, but also a separate brain in each leg. There's no point of connection there in terms of physical reality. I know what water feels like, it's wet. But, and yet, when you read about octopuses, they have personalities, they have intelligence, a lot of intelligence, actually. So there's something there in common. We have personalities, we have intelligence. And when you read stories about octopuses, you can tell. It's like they respond to situations in ways that we find we can relate to. There was a story that went around the internet a while ago about Inky the octopus, who lived for a time in an aquarium in Napier in New Zealand. Inky became world famous when he found a way out and escaped into the ocean. You know, he found his way out of his aquarium, across the floor, and he found the drain, and out he went. And everybody was going, go, Inky, go. You know, it's like, we can relate to that. Get me out of here. And finding a way. So we don't know what an octopus feels or knows. But we can see that it responds to the world. He, she responds to the world. And of course, there's the danger of projection here, of projecting our own feelings onto somebody like Inky the octopus. Because really, we can't possibly know what he or she might be feeling. But we don't need to. actually. And I'll go on with that vein just in a little while. But first, I want to also speak to how with this category of all beings, not only on top of this not knowing, there is, the extension of what is our usual self-centeredness to relate to all other beings as the other in big block letters. And these beings are the other that we're somehow better than. Mostly as human beings, we do not question this assumption. It's just the way we relate to the world. We collectively take it for granted that somehow we're above the rest of biological life. Maybe not above devas, but, you know, above all the forms of animals and plants that we know better than. And our languages reflect this. In Burma, for example, when you count things, people, there are modifiers. And the words that are used as modifiers make these views of relative status explicit. So there's a modifier you use for monastics, one you use for ordinary people, and one you use for animals. So, you know, that hierarchy is obviously there. And actually, in English, we do the same thing. It's not through the language so much as in Burmese. But, for example, if you're talking about cattle, for example, you talk about head of cattle. You would never talk about how many head of people. No, you use that word only for herds of animals that are somehow better than us, counted by the number of heads. Likewise, in English, pronouns and how we use them. And I can only speak for English and maybe French, but English is most familiar. And we say he, she about people. And personally, I find this forever annoying when I do it and when I see it a lot, like if I read the news, it being used as the pronoun for an animal, whether that particular dog, cat, horse, octopus is a he or a she. It's always an it, a thing, somehow not a he or she. That's a little too close to us. Of course, if you know that particular animal, maybe it's your dog, it's always a he or a she. It's not an it. So you see, when there is a little closeness, that itness begins to go away. And the challenge of all beings as a category in the metta practice is to remove that barrier of it between us and the roughly 9 million other life forms that we share this planet with, just in terms of biological beings. And then all the other sentient beings that we can't even know or see. Nine million is a number. And I'm just referring to animals, biological beings other than humans, because they've been roughly counted and we know a number. We don't know a number for devas, yakas, mahidikas, all those other beings. But biological beings, there's a rough number of 9 million. If you were to speak the name of each of these species without a break, it would take about 3.5 months to get through the list. That's what 9 million is. It's a lot. A lot of beings. And in the metta practice, we begin to notice how we give human higher status than other beings. And it actually seems built into those categories, with people first, individual people first, and then others. At the end, in all beings. And it seems at first glance to be almost as an afterthought. But that's actually not the way it's meant. It's not at all an afterthought. When you look at the Metta Sutta and all the early texts that we're chanting, there's no people first and other beings later. It's just whatever living beings there may be, whether they're big, small, short, tall, near, far away, born, coming to birth. All of them together, unbounded. This metta is unbounded. But when you get to the Visuddhimagga, there is this list of categories. And this is the traditional practice that is handed down to us. Because it works. Rather than these categories being an expression of status, of relative status, actually, they reflect not status, but familiarity. That's the whole point of these categories. We start with people because we are people. If we were all dogs doing metta, we'd be starting with dogs. That's a joke, but you know, it's like we start where we are, and we are familiar with people, so we start with people. And we start with familiar people, easy people, and go out from there. And once we have a handle on accessing this boundless care towards people we respect, people we're close to, people we don't know, people we might have a grudge against, then, only then, can we begin to open up to this vast, uncountable, unknowable mass of living beings that starts with that 9 million biological beings and includes others. This unboundedness of true metta is all-encompassing. So when we're working with this category of all beings, fortunately, we don't have to visualize each one. We cannot. It's impossible. But the heart can open to all of them anyway. We don't have to see them or know them. But we do have to connect, and I admit, it can be a challenge. I mean all beings. So if you find this category difficult, there are ways to make it easier to access this knownness of beings. Easier to purify this delusion of unknowing. And there's so many possibilities. There's no recipe you have to follow here. The guideline, the main instruction, is to start where it's easy. So one way that people classically do this, I mean, Sayadaw just says, okay, now radiate metta to all beings, and that's all he says, which is basically what it says in the Visuddhimagga. But fortunately there, it gives a few ways of opening. And one of them is to start where you are in space. Start with yourself. And then gradually move outward to the people around you, to the people in the room, to the people in the monastery, to the people in the neighborhood, the city, the country, the world, all beings. That's one way of gradually purifying that delusion of disconnection. But there's so many possible ways of doing this. Another way is by way of the 10 directions, which is what you've been given the instruction to do yesterday. So all beings in the east, all beings in the west, the north, the south, the northeast, southwest, and so on, above, below, and all around. Using the direction as a bit of a crutch. Okay, I can imagine in front of me or behind me. So you can expand by way of proximity, you can expand by way of direction, or you can get creative. One way I've found that works actually pretty well is to go through the sequence of metta categories again. But instead of putting human beings, a single human being, in those categories, I put groups of beings. So, benefactors. Or myself, so all human beings. Benefactors. All devas. Dear friends. Get creative. All border collies. No. Neutral people. Instead of neutral people, have some being you just don't have any, you don't care one way or another. All herring. Disliked beings. Oh, this is a vaster field. All cockroaches. You know, so you can play with these categories. So you can gradually work to the place of being open to beings that are unknown, all beings, but by way of your ability to connect, whether you like or dislike them. And we can use beings that are easy to connect with as proxies for the rest. For those unknowable, uncountable rest of they, he, she. Just to shine the light of metta. That's all you need to do. It's like you can imagine some being that you can connect with and use that. Sometimes it can feel like holding the earth in your hand or the universe in your hands. And where you can connect, a being with whom you can connect is like dropping a stone in a pond and the ripples go out to all those others that you can't even see. So all the whales in the Southern Ocean and all beings. You know, using one being and letting that be your doorway in can also be very helpful. And all that's necessary is we just shine the metta in that direction. Let it be like a searchlight. And it touches everything it meets, whether we know that being or not. And when we can do this, the world, we see the world and the universe in so much more of an inclusive lens, really, that doesn't put me or my kind in a central and more important place. And it's a lens that connects all those beings equally. And those barriers that Sayadaw was talking about yesterday get broken down. And this is really an opening into compassion as well for non-human beings. There's a wonderful story that Joanna Macy tells, meeting a Rinpoche in India. And he had offered her tea and noticed that swimming in her cup was a fly. And so he reached in with his finger and scooped the fly up and quickly took it out. And she was going, oh no, it's okay, thinking he was concerned for her welfare. And when he came back in, he was beaming and said, he's going to be all right. And explained to her he'd put the fly on the leaf and it had dried off and everything was okay. And she thought, oh my goodness, you know, I thought he was worried about me, but the fly, he's going to be all right. This is how that boundlessness of metta and compassion manifests. The person in front of you, the fly and the cup, are equal. Both objects of great concern and care. And to the extent that to which we think as human beings that this is weird and strange, well, you know, he's going to be okay. Well, you know, who cares about the fly? That's the extent to which the metta needs to be purified. And I really loved it yesterday that Sayadaw said, test your metta. With all beings, it's easy to get complacent because we can rest with an idea of all beings. But is there really that boundlessness there? Or are there some beings who, well, they're on their own? So see if you can find, if it feels to you like this metta is very established, find beings that cause the mind to recoil a little bit. See if you can. And it can be a real challenge, actually. But to the, you know, all of us are not arahants, I don't think. Speaking for myself, I know I'm far from that. So, until we're completely enlightened, there are going to be edges. There are going to be places where we go, ugh. And this can be an interesting process. It's like, where are those edges in this category of all beings? So that's the purification of not knowing with this category, these two categories. The other thread that I wanted to mention that runs through both the suttas and the Visuddhimagga is the purification, of course, of ill will. This is the other thing that gets mentioned again and again and again and again. In addition to that purification that comes with boundlessness, with equality of beings, there is the purification that comes with being able to open with care and kindness, no matter what. And the complete purity of that. I spoke of this already quite a bit in my last talk, and Arya may also speak a little more to it. I just want to mention in this context the repeated reality checks in the sutta that we chant that are so obvious. And It's fairly interesting as you're going through the chant again. Oh, there's this place where the Buddha says, without hostility and without ill will. Well, what's that doing in there? Why is the Buddha talking again about hostility and ill will? It comes up a couple of times in various ways. And it's though he's saying, it's remember without any ill will, okay? No, just not to forget, no ill will there. With no holding back, no loathing, no foe. In Pali, asambhadam, awaram, asapatam. You know, he puts a pin in those places to remind us. This. Freed from hatred, free from ill will. And that's his way of saying, as a rule, as a general rule, cultivate metta. Do not ever, ever cultivate dosa, ill will, no matter how subtle. Preference is a form of dosa. It's really subtle, but it's when you prefer some over others, they're always the others. They, those its. And there are no exceptions or excuses the Buddha gives for this. There's no place where he says it's okay to cultivate dosa. Here are a few confronting verses from the Dhammapada. He says, your outer adornments and pseudo-spiritual preoccupations are irrelevant if inwardly you remain in disarray. Suffering subsides to the degree that you are free from the intention to cause harm. There is no real greatness if there is no restraint of anger. Okay. And then, of course, in the Majjhima Nikaya, there are those instructions that I shared last time from the simile of the saw. So even if bandits cut your arms and legs off, radiate metta to them without ill will. Unbounded, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. Oh. This is completely non-negotiable. And we want to negotiate. But the Buddha didn't say it's okay to care about these people, the good ones, and not those, the bad ones. He never said, oh, this evil person is outside the range of metta. And he knew the difference. There were many people in the Buddha's life who created no small trouble for him, tried to kill him on repeated occasions. His cousin, Devadatta, trying to take over the Sangha from him. And there are many stories in the suttas of people who most of us would go, For example, Angulimala, who was a very gifted scholar and student, but had created, for no fault of his own, some jealousy, and so was tricked into collecting a mala, a necklace of fingers. Tricked by his teacher into believing that if he offered 1,000 fingers, then his studies would be complete. And he murdered 999 people. And then he encountered his mother and was on the verge of murdering her when the Buddha showed up and stopped him and accepted him when Angulimala kind of came to his senses, accepted him into the community of monks with a lot of compassion. A mass murderer, 999 people. And when, as a monk, he encountered difficulty, as he did a lot of times, people would throw things at him, not offer him food. The Buddha very kindly, but straightly said, "Bear it, bhikkhu, bear it. You have to let your karma be purified. This is the consequence of action." But there was metta in that. There was compassion in that. So the Buddha understood that, you know, beings can be bad. Human beings can be rotten, nasty. So yes, individual people can do terrible things to each other and to non-human beings. And we, humanity as a whole, are doing lots of terrible things to everybody on this planet, creating a global extinction crisis of geological proportions. I mean, it's... there it is. And it's horrible to contemplate what we're doing. And we can hate the individual people who do bad things. We can hate ourselves and humanity in general for being what we are. But no good comes from that. Remember how the Buddha said in the Dhammapada, hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone. So there is the metta. And intuitively, we all know this, which is why we're here. And here we are in the middle of this retreat, kind of grappling with the mind. Grappling with the obscurations, the ways in which the metta is obscured by delusion and by ill will. So with all of these texts, these are the two things that we are most facing with this practice. And we get glimmers of the metta, because it's only obscured. It's not like we have to create it. It's obscured by those fixed views, by identification with our ideas of how we are and how people are and how beings are, how they should be, all those ideas, all that conditioning. And the point of this practice, by whatever means we undertake it, whether just by abiding, radiating loving kindness to all beings, as in the suttas, or using the categories, as the Visuddhimagga teaches us, by whatever means we undertake this practice of cultivating loving kindness, it releases the heart from those obscurations. Everyone here has struggled to a certain extent, and everybody here is succeeding to some extent or another, up and down. As you all know by now, yes, it does go up and down. And to see the many ups and downs in the practice, this is what takes us beyond discouragement and elation to the heart of pure metta that is acceptance, without preferences, without ill will. So just patiently continuing is what we have to do. I want to close with a lovely poem that was written by Mary Oliver, who recently died in her 80s. And I really like it. It's called Hallelujah. Everyone should be born into this world happy and loving everything. But in truth, it rarely works that way. For myself, I've spent my life clamoring toward it. Hallelujah. Anyway, I'm not where I started. And have you too been trudging like that? Sometimes almost forgetting how wondrous the world is and how miraculously kind some people can be? And have you also decided that probably nothing important is ever easy? Not, say, for the first 60 years. Hallelujah. I'm 60 now, and even a little more. And some days, I feel I have wings. So, may the wings of your metta grow ever stronger. Thank you for your practice, and thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.